He gestured towards the portal.
What I'm getting at is, this don't make no sense. It's a scorny thing, boss,
Mogrot said, puzzled.
Does it have to make sense?
Uftak gritted his teeth in irritation. On the one hand, no, it didn't. Scrawnies and spikies were weird gits, and that was an end to it. Even humies made a sort of sense in a kind of weak and pathetic way. They were a bit like orcs, just generally really, really bad at it. Scrawnies and spikies, on the other hand, well, who knew what was going on in their heads? They were obviously thinking. It wasn't like they were bug eyes, which were basically like squigs in terms of their determination to get a meal at all costs, and gave little indication of being aware of anything else. No, scrawnies and spikies were kind of smart in their own way, but it was a zoggin' strange way. There was absolutely no reason why what they did, and why they did it, should make any sense to an orc. But on the other hand, Uftak was increasingly sure that it should make sense. Well, that was the problem with thinking. It was difficult to work out where to stop. Once upon a time, when confronted by an obstacle like this, he'd have tried to blow it up to get through. If that didn't work, which he was sure it wouldn't, because he was increasingly suspicious that the spaces linked by these gates weren't exactly next to each other, as he would understand it, then he would have just turned around and got to work stomping all the spikies he could reach. He'd wanted a fight, he'd found a fight, and the old Uftak would have been happy with that. This Uftak, though, couldn't settle for it. Something was bothering him, like a splinter in his mind that not even Doc Drosvan could have removed. If it took a scrawny or a spiky to open a gate, then there had to be a reason why the others had opened and this one wouldn't. It angered Uftak that his brain was betraying him like this, refusing to let him be happy with what was, on the face of it, a perfectly good fight. There was nothing for it, though. He tried punching himself in the head to see if it shook the thoughts loose, but nothing happened other than he bruised his knuckles.
You were right, boss,
Mogrot asked, sounding a little concerned. It was hardly as though Uftak's welfare was going to be high on Mogrot's list of priorities, since if Uftak got blown up, then Mogrot Redtooth would probably laugh at him, then set about scrapping to try to become the next big boss, in which case might Gawk and Morg help any lads who ended up under his command. Still, any orc was going to be a bit worried if they thought their boss wasn't in his right mind. That was a problem. Uftak was in too much of his right mind. He had more mind than he knew what to do with, and right now it was insisting to him that his presence here, and that of his boys, was not just the result of fortuitous chance, or Gawk and Morg sending them on their way to have a good old scrap. Someone wanted him here. Someone more immediate than a pair of mighty green deities in wherever it was that gods lived. Given that only scrawnies or spikies could normally tell the gates what to do, that led to a fairly obvious conclusion about the nature of said someone. As to why a spiky might want a massive load of orcs to turn up in their home, well, that was something Uftak couldn't yet puzzle out. Maybe it was as simple as setting two of your rivals up to have a scrap because you wanted a laugh. Maybe the spiky in question thought they'd laid some sort of fancy trap. Maybe, no, wait, go back to the trap one. Uftak looked around again. One way in, no ways out. Well, other than possibly the way in, but no self-respecting orc boss was going to turn everyone around to go back the way they came. Go into a place, wreck it, and come out the other side. That was the orc way. So, given that the Spikies knew this place better than Uftak's lads did, this might actually not be a half-bad trap after all. Uftak was in no mood to be caught in someone else's trap, no matter how nasty a surprise his would-be captor was going to get when they came to check on what they'd caught. He turned around, took a deep breath, and bellowed.
Boffin!
There was a gratifyingly short delay before Uftak's chief mech boy appeared, zooming through the crowd of orcs and grots who were milling back and forth, shouting and ignoring orders. However, de Boffin's method of transportation seemed a little different to usual, and Uftak furrowed his brow in confusion as the mech pulled up in front of him.
"That's not touching the ground," he said, pointing at de Boffin's monowheel.
It was indeed floating a hand's breadth above what passed for the ground here, rotating very slightly.
"Yeah, found some of those spiky floaty generators,"
de Boffin grinned happily, pointed to some new glowy bits on his lower half.
"Thought it might be a laugh."
"But you're keeping the wheel."
"Obviously,"
de Boffin said, looking hurt at the very suggestion.
"Don't know how long these things are going to last for. It's only spiky tech after all. Can't beat a good wheel for reliability when all's said and done. Also, I can't find a way to turn the floaty off again, but I'm sure that's just temporary. Anyway, boss,"
he continued, as Uftak's expression started to shift towards the boredom which might lead to remedial violence,
"I've been taking readings of the buildings round about, and I reckon that one,"
he pointed towards a particularly jagged tower,
"it's going to be the best bet for finding something snazzy inside it. It's got the highest power consumption, and there's got to be a reason for that."
Uftak nodded. The normal thing to do would be to order everyone nearby to attack the tower in question, but thinking was taking place again.
"Do you reckon you could use their power?"
he asked, causing de Boffin's forehead to wrinkle.
"Reckon so, boss. It's all just energy, isn't it? Might need a bit of tampering with whatever we're hooking it up to, but that shouldn't be a problem."
His expression brightened. The face of a mech boy who could see an immediate future consisting of mucking around with wires, tools, and electrocuted grots.
"What's the plan?"
Uftak told him the plan, and de Boffin's grin widened until it nearly reached from ear to ear.
"I like it, boss. Yeah, that should work. I'll get my spanners to bring the bits up."
He turned to zoom away, but Uftak caught him by the shoulder.
"How high does that thing go?"
he asked, nodding towards de Boffin's newly floating lower half.
"Oh, dunno, boss. The things I nicked it from zipped about quite high, so it should be fine."
"Right. Then before you go, get up there,"
Uftak said, pointing to the head of a stomper that was thumping around a short distance away.
"And tell the captain that I want him to give us away into that."
He pointed again, this time at the base of the spire de Boffin had highlighted as being the one with the greatest power consumption.
"You got it, boss,"
de Boffin said gleefully. His new additions glowed brighter and whined louder, and he cackled in glee as he rose up into the air and headed off, a little unsteadily, towards the giant war machine in question. Uftak watched him for long enough to be reasonably sure that he was going to make it, then unslung the snazhammer, ignited the power field around it, and raised it into the air. Even amidst the generalized chaos that was an orcish invasion in full swing, the big boss standing tall and holding his weapon up was enough to garner attention. Nearby orcs stopped what they were doing and turned to look, and their mates turned to see what they were looking at, and then their mates turned around and so on and so on.
"All right, listen up,"
Uftak roared. He levelled the snazhammer to point at the spire that was his target, nearly splitting a nearby beast snagger in two in the process.
"We're about to go and give everything in there a sogging good kicking. Only one thing I want you lot to remember. If there's anything what looks like it's all technological, leave it in one piece, because I want de Boffin looking at it."
The surrounding orcs nodded. They were the tech war, after all. While most of them had no particular interest in shiny gizmos and gubbins that didn't directly kill anything, they were familiar with de Mech Lord's particular interests, and knew that orcs who wrecked something he wanted didn't last long.
Oh, one other thing,
Uftak added with a grin, as the stomper began to ponderously rotate and decline its guns.
Stand back for a second, because it's about to get a bit loud.
The spiky leaped to Uftak with a high-pitched scream, and a knife so thin it seemed almost non-existent. Uftak simply shoved the top of the snazhammer straight at his chest, not bothering with either hammer surface or chopper blade. And the spiky practically impaled its own ribcage with the pathetic snapping noise of thin bones giving way. It fell to the floor, its face racked with pain, but also a sort of infuriated betrayal, as though it was shocked and outraged that Uftak had been quick enough to foil its attack. Uftak stamped on its head, and annoyingly resilient though the things were, given their gangly build, he was sufficiently heavy to crush its skull underfoot without difficulty. That was the problem with fights these days. It just didn't get them like you used to. Most gits had slowed down since Uftak was a youth, to the point that he barely had to try anymore. Back in the day, when he was just a boy in Bad Git Snazhammer's mob, he'd have been slugging and chopping away, narrowly avoiding death every other second and feeling incredibly alive as a result. It wasn't that fighting was boring now, far from it, but it was difficult to find the same rush of adventure and fulfillment from it when most enemies seemed to lack any ability to get close to you. This did not, of course, mean that Uftak had any intention of deliberately giving the Gits a chance just to make things a bit more interesting. If they couldn't be bothered to be any good at fighting, he certainly wasn't going to make it easy for them.
Anyone else want some?
He roared, waving the snazhammer, but the last spiky apparently decided that it did not, in fact, want some, and turned to flee. Uftak hurled the snazhammer at its fast-retreating back, and the powered blade side nearly bisected the luckless creature. It fell to the floor, instantly dead, and Uftak clenched his fist to trigger the button built into the palm of his armoured gauntlet. Throwing the snazhammer was fun and often effective, but it did lead to the problem of Uftak being over here and his weapon being over there, which was just inconvenient and downright disrespectful. He'd had a word with the boffin about it, and the mech had rigged up a new device that should solve the problem, calling the weapon back to Uftak's hand via a miniature teleport homer. In theory. What happened this time was that the weapon reappeared a few feet to his right and behind him, coincidentally right in the middle of one of his lads. There was a brief and unpleasant moment when both objects tried to occupy the same space, and then the orc in question, Zodrag, Uftak thought, exploded wetly. Uftak reached out and grabbed the snazhammer before it fell to the ground, but there was nothing to be done for Zodrag, who was now mainly just limbs without anything really left to which they could be reattached. Everyone laughed, including Uftak. If you had to die, then it might as well be funny.
Anyone else?
He shouted after the laughter had died down a bit, but only silence replied. The spiky tower was just as sleek and polished and confusing as its residents, somehow combining shiny surfaces and shadowy darkness, not to mention a layout that defied anything Uftak considered logical. They were less than a third of the way up, but if he'd been actually trying to get anywhere in particular, then Uftak was certainly would be hopelessly lost, thanks to switchback staircases, dead-end corridors and secret doors. His lads had been ambushed from behind twice by spiky fighters slipping out of concealed entrances and burying their blades into orcish flesh before their presence had been registered. But each time the Gits had overestimated the psychological impact of their appearance. A lot of species, Uftak supposed, would be shaken by an enemy suddenly showing up next to them. For orcs, it just meant your attempt to find a fight had been even more successful than you'd anticipated. There was still no response to his challenge. Whoever was left in this tower was showing no signs of coming out and fighting for it, and Uftak was fed up of hunting spikies down just to kill a few of them at a time. He waved one hand dismissively.
All right, lads, go get 'em. I'm going back to talk to the boffin.
The boys with him, who'd been hanging back so as not to get clobbered by their big boss for running into the enemy before him, surged forward with whoops of glee and indiscriminate firing of assorted weaponry. Uftak shoved his way through them, passing scenes of slaughter and random destruction, until he found himself back on the lower levels again, where de Boffin and his spanners were busy hooking a bunch of thick cables up to several strange stones. These glowed with a sickly light, and the mechs were convinced they held whatever the spikies used as energy.
"What's your boss?"
the boffin greeted him.
"How's it? Nazlog! Don't touch them!"
There was an extremely loud fizzling noise, and an orc caught fire and flew backwards across the room. Everyone had a good old laugh while he rolled around slapping at the flames, then got back to work again when they caught sight of Uftak's glower.
"Anyway, boss, how's it going up there?"
the boffin asked genially, absent-mindedly scratching his head with a tool that seemed to have at least three different points on it.
"Spikies, innit?"
Uftak said with a shrug.
"They jump at you. Someone gets stabbed. You stomp 'em and move on to find the next lot. But they're not the proper fighters, and I don't want to be waiting around for 'em to come and get us when they're nice and ready. Well, I think we got it all sorted now,"
the boffin said, smacking his hands together in a satisfied manner.
"Let's go outside and see what's what."
Uftak followed him back out to where some more of de Boffin's assistants had set up a series of large metal plates that were bolted together into a sort of second floor, and to which the cables snaking out of the spiky's tower were attached. Two menacing-looking pylons towered over the plates, pointing downwards and inwards towards whatever might be standing on them. At the moment, a mob of 30 or so boys fidgeted around with the restlessness of orcs who weren't doing anything exciting right now, but had been told that if they could just stand still for a bit, they could shortly be doing something really exciting.
"Fire it up!"
de Boffin yelled, and a particularly oily grot leaped onto a lever and dragged it downwards with its body weight. Lights ignited all over the device, and power began to crackle around the tips of the pylons.
"Yes!"
the boffin shouted gleefully, and zoomed over to inspect the dials.
"Power levels are holding steady. Good thinking, boss. The spikies are giving us the juice to make it work." "Make it work, then,"
Uftak ordered. The boffin grinned at him and twisted a large dial. A pulsing, throbbing noise began, deep enough at first to cause intestinal discomfort, then rapidly rising to a pitch beyond hearing, and at which earwax began to dissolve. Then, just as Uftak was starting to feel as though his head were being clamped between the forks of a power claw, there was an exceptionally loud pop, and all of the boys on the plate disappeared. Uftak looked at the boffin.
"Did it work?" "Put a detector on one of them,"
the boffin said smugly, pulling out a device and consulting it.
"I didn't know exactly where I was sending them, but if I get a signal back, then they ended up more or less in the right place." "And what if you don't get a signal back?"
Uftak asked. The boffin shrugged.
"Then they're probably in the realm of the gods, fighting those weird gribbly things what hang around with the chaos gits."
Something lit up on his device and he cackled.
"There we go. They got to wherever they're going, okay."
Another light came on.
"And the knob pushed a button, which means they found something to fight and all."
Uftak nodded, satisfied. Thinking was sometimes a pain, but it also had its benefits. His lads weren't just going to sit around and wait for the spikies to come to them. Oh, no.
"Get your asses over here," he bellowed. "Anyone who ain't fighting a spiky right now, get on the teleport pad. You're going on a trip."
Chapter 8. Dimera had a plan. Lure the orcs in by sacrificing a proud, desperate, self-proclaimed Archon and his so-called cabal. Trapped them in Sabregate, a location which had little value to her, then rally the other factions of Port Tavar behind her to eradicate the brutes. Everyone got a fresh supply of slaves and victims, and the strife that had so damaged this district of Camorra was ended as a new leader emerged. Her. With that stability recovered, everyone could turn their attention back to raiding real space and predating on the galaxy's lesser species and give only the usual amount of thought to betrayal and deception, rather than being prepared for full-blown conflict to erupt at any moment. By taking command, she would actually be doing everyone a favour. However, despite her warriors' assurances that the Webway portals out of Sabregate were deactivated and there was no way that the orcs could be getting through them, the wretched creatures were somehow not remaining trapped. Dimera knew well enough that orcs sometimes refused to recognise that they were dead until long after the time when their bodies should have given up. She had not previously been aware that they could apparently also refuse to recognise the laws of physics.
"Find out what is happening," she hissed at Zesk, as raiders and Venom split off from the assembled flotilla to head towards the disturbances around them. "Get the artisans here to inspect the portals. I want to know how the Araki are getting out and how far this is spreading."
"Yes, mistress," Zesk said obediently, although Dimera could tell that her Drakon was resentful of being the first recipient of her rage and frustration. No matter. He would either remind himself of how privileged his existence was, or she would publicly flay the skin from his flesh as an object lesson to all those whom she had rewarded for their service. However, even if it was required, such an extravagance might have to wait until after the immediate challenges facing them had been resolved.
"Are you certain you're up for this, Dimera?" Vern called mockingly.
It appeared that the Archon of the Cabal of the Falling Night was not concerned by these developments, or at any rate not concerned enough to let it prevent him from undermining Dimera's shaky authority. At least, Dimera reminded herself, no one could laugh at the failure of her plan, since no one else knew that she had intended for the orcs to come here in the first place. It was perfectly natural for her to be angry about the Araki further sullying Camorra with their presence. Paranoia lanced in, sharp and sudden. Why was Vern so unconcerned? Was this part of his scheme? A scheme Dimera had not even considered until now. Had Vern somehow arranged for the orcs to break out of Sabregate in order to make Dimera's victory less assured and so then take power for himself? In fact, had everything, Dalgar's near death, Dimera's own scheme, and now the unexpected appearance of orcs within Port Tavar proper, merely come about from the labyrinthine puppeteering of Sistriel Vern? No, Dimera refused to believe it. The Archon of the Cabal of the Fallen Night was formidable, but he lacked that sort of long-term subtlety. This was the Arrakia refusing to play their part, that was all. An aggravating stubbornness that Dimera should have foreseen. No matter. She would adapt her scheme accordingly, find the nature and location of the breaches, and seal them off before leading the forces of Port Tavar to...
"Mistress!"
Ilioneth Zesk shouted, as a flare of green energy erupted overhead. Dimera just had time to feel her skin tingle in a manner she had never before experienced, and then the sky opened and began to disgorge orcs. They fell in a bellowing storm, at least 24 hulking monstrosities in crude black and yellow clothing and armour. Dimera realised after half a second that the creatures weren't yelling in panic as they fell. They were roaring war cries, or even laughing exuberantly. The Arrakia were the children of destruction, after all, and they lived only for warfare. It appeared that they had very little concern about how they reached a fight, or where the fight actually was, so long as they got there. Drukhari reflexes were more than equal to the appearance of these enemies, and splinter rifles were raised and firing before the first orcs had fallen more than a few feet.
However, it swiftly became apparent to Dimera that even an already poisoned orc could cause a great deal of problems in such a situation. They were massive creatures, each one perhaps three times the weight of a Drukhari, even without their armour and weaponry, and they were falling directly onto Port Tavar's fleet of skimmers. One such body, already limp and with the light fading from its eyes as Drukhari toxins took effect, landed on the very front of her Venom's nose. The vehicle's internal stabilising systems were tuned to hair-fine settings in order for the pilot to best jink and dodge enemy weapons fire, but could do nothing about the sudden impact of several hundred pounds of orcish muscle and war gear arriving at a decent fraction of its terminal velocity. The Venom's nose went down and backwards violently. The craft's rear end, in accordance with physics, was propelled upwards and forwards by the same degree. Dimera could have made a desperate grab for a rail and be left hanging like some desperate slave while her pilot tried to right the vehicle, but in the split second in which she made a decision, she instead opted to boost herself off. Drukhari might be slight compared to many of the galaxy's other species, but they were almost unmatched in terms of the strength-to-weight ratio of their bodies. Dimera could run fast enough and jump high enough to outpace and outmaneuver most of her potential enemies, and she put the power in her frame to good use now. Her legs combined with the momentum of her flipping venom to propel her through the air, and she somersaulted across the gap between her craft and that of the Tantalus of the Cabal of the Fallen Knight. She landed lightly on one of its twin prows, her own weight barely registering on the far larger vehicle, but then it shuddered as a handful of orcs crashed down onto it. Kabbalite warriors were skilled combatants, but they were equipped to engage the enemy at range and bring them down under a withering hail of toxic splinters and other more exotic weaponry. They focused on highly mobile firepower, striking and fading while mounted on their raiders and never letting the enemy close with them. It was the durable monsters of the Homunculus Covens, the Blade Masters of the Incubus Shrines, or the Quicksilver Gladiators of the Witch Cults, who fought foes blade to blade and brought them down with obscene power, impeccable technique, or blinding speed. Against a human, a Tau, or any number of other species, a Drukhari could hold their own even without access to melee weapons, but orcs were another matter entirely. Their brute strength made even their crude blades deadly, and they ignored blows that would stun or incapacitate lesser foes. Orcs cared nothing for the artistry of the blade, for the dance of blows or the subtle kiss of toxins. They were not privy to the Suladeeth, the language of cuts, whereby a skilled warrior demonstrated their disdain, or indeed grudging respect, for an adversary through the placement and depth of the wounds they inflicted. Orcs just killed. There was no finesse and little technique. But by the living Muse himself, Dimera reflected as five orcs tore apart their own number of Kabbalite warriors within a second or so, they were terrifying. The Drukhari's way of war was based around their mobility. In fact, the idea was never to wage war at all, as lesser species would understand it. The denizens of the Dark City did not embark on crusades of conquest such as those undertaken by the wretched Monki, whichever foul gods they worshipped, the Tau and their deluded lackeys, or even the Orcs themselves. Drukhari struck hard, took what they wanted, and departed while their enemies lay bleeding. They sought no territory in real space. They merely predated on those that did, and their vehicles were key to their success. Now, however, those vehicles were no refuge. While some of the orcs fell past with limbs flailing, plummeting towards the ground below, the crew of those craft unlucky enough to have one or more of the brutes land on them found that they now had very little room in which to manoeuvre. An orc took up a lot of space on a narrow Drukhari vessel and were hard to shift. Dimera saw a crew of the Tantalus swing acrobatically around the ether sail mast and slam feet first into one of the boarders, only to bounce off and land on the deck while the orc in question did little more than rock slightly to one side. Then, The foul creature levelled its massive sidearm, a weapon shaped like a pistol, but nearly the size of a Drukhari's chest, and fired a slug as thick as Dimera's arm into its attacker. Not even an orc could miss at that range. The warrior's breastplate shattered, and most of their upper body disintegrated, and the orc let out a grotesque snickering laugh, which only ended when Sistriel Verne lopped its head off with a sweep of his powered blade. The Archon of the Cabal of the Fallen Knight flowed into combat like a warrior god of ancient times, his power sword shimmering and his hair fanning out like snow spray. His weapon carved up a second orc with a trio of slashes nearly too swift for the eye to follow, two crossways, alternating direction, and then a third up the middle of the enemy's torso. The rising star, an indication that the galaxy would spin on without noticing the death of this insignificant life form, then sheared through the descending blade of a third. Despite the fact that Verne's power sword looked like a mere sliver in comparison to the massive wedge of sharp metal against which it was pitted, the orc paused for a moment to gape at the failure of its strike and the remaining stub of the weapon in its hand, and Verne took its left leg off at the knee, then thrust his blade straight through its face. That was the lance. A gesture of derision, not towards the Blademaster's victim, so much as the victim's companions. The implication being that they were so slow and unskilled that the Drukhari warrior could take the time to embed their blade in their enemy's flesh and withdraw it again without endangering themselves. One of the remaining three orcs apparently decided that enough was enough and pulled the trigger on an ugly, elongated lump of a weapon which belched flame that stank of chemicals. The blast engulfed the orc directly in front of the firer, which howled in pain, but Verne flipped up and over the fire, then vaulted lightly off the burning orc's head before landing and bringing his power sword down to bisect the flame wielder cleanly down its centre line. Not even an orc could survive such a blow, and Verne flipped his sword up, caught it in a reversed grip, and stabbed out backwards without looking to sever the spine of the burning hulk behind him, which collapsed. It had been a performance of deadly, balletic grace, and Verne brought his blade up and around almost casually to dispatch his final opponent. But his sword was caught between the massive prongs of a massive claw prosthetic, which also crackled with the energy of a power field, and the huge orc that wielded it, a boss or knob, as Dimera understood their crude dialect, lashed out with the butt of its enormous rifle-type weapon to club Verne square in his shocked face. The Archon of the Cabal of the Falling Knight was knocked bodily into the boom of the ether cells, leaving his power blade behind in his enemy's grasp as he slumped to the deck. The orc closed its claw and shattered the weapon in its grip, then drew its arm back to impale Verne on its talons. Dimera could have let it happen. She could have watched the orc dispatch her stunned rival, then slain the brute herself and taken command of the Tantalus. These massive craft were rare and expensive, and it would be a boost to her authority if she were to procure one, no matter the manner in which she came into possession of it. The few remaining crew would be unlikely to give her trouble. Indeed, with their Archon gone, they might well seek to get into her good graces. However, something spurred her into action from the other half of the Tantalus's twin hull. She drew her blast pistol and fired it. The dark light energy coursed out of her weapon and struck the orc, not with physical force, but with pure destructive power. The orc paused for a moment to assess this new threat, and Dimera drew her own blade and moved to attack. Her blast pistol had done little more than singe the orc, but that was because it had first burned away a large chunk of the crude but thick armour plating with which the creature had covered itself. Now Dimera's blade flicked out, searching for the green flesh that had been exposed or the soft and vulnerable cloth that lay beneath and between its remaining armour. Her weapon was not empowered like Sistriel Verne's had been, but it held a danger all its own. This was a venom blade, and the micropores in its surface constantly wept lightly with hypertoxins distilled from venerous gotials, dusky slinkworms, and other foul creatures of Camorra's shadows. The orc roared in rage at being denied its prey and lashed out with its powered claw in a ferocious backswing. Dimera made no attempt to block or parry the blow. She knew she could not match the brute for strength, and her blade would simply shatter from the force with which the orc had swung its weapon, let alone the power field that enveloped it. She stepped back instead, her nostrils filling with the stench of ozone as the tips of the claw passed just beneath her nose and ionized the air on their way past. Vileth's blood, but the beast was fast. Still, startlingly quick though the orc was for its size, and despite the formidable combination that made with its massive strength, Dimera was quicker still. She rocked back off her heels and sprang forwards, darting across the orc's front and cutting at his thigh with the tip of her venom blade. The point of her weapon pierced the rough black cloth and bit into the flesh beneath, and then she was rolling underneath the clubbing swing of its gun barrel to end up on its far side. The hypertoxins would be in the beast's bloodstream now, which meant its death was inevitable. But inevitable was not the same thing as imminent. Most enemies would succumb to even a mild scratch within a few seconds, but Dimera had seen Vern underestimate this brute and come undone as a result, and was determined not to do the same. Instead of posing triumphantly and waiting for her prey to fall at her feet with bulging eyes and choking on bloody froth, she stabbed again and again, sending her blade darting into the creature's back and slipping between its ribs where there were gaps in its haphazardly affixed armour. The orc bellowed in pain and rage as the organs she punctured began to fail and shut down, and its furious circling to bring her within its reach got more desperate and uncoordinated as the moments dragged on. Finally, its exertions overtaxed its ailing nervous system, and it collapsed with a sound like an avalanche in a foundry. Sistriel Vern had pushed himself up to his knees, but froze as the tip of Dimera's venom blade caressed the underside of his chin. Dimera applied the very slightest upward pressure, just enough to force her rival to tilt his chin and look her in the eye. The merest breath of additional force, the slightest twitch of Dimera's wrist, and the fate of the Archon of the Cabal of the Falling Night would be sealed. And yet, Vern met Dimera's gaze without blinking or flinching. There was no fear of the envenomed blade there, despite the fact that he could surely feel the point pricking against his skin. He mouthed no plea for mercy, did not shrink uselessly back from the weapon as though a few inches of space could save him if Dimera decided to take his life.
"Do it if you dare," his glare seemed to say, "but for your own sake you had best not miss."
Sistriel Vern did not give up his power. And, Dimera realised, this was a prospect that excited her. "A formidable showing," she said, withdrawing her blade and sheathing it. "A shame the big brute caught you off guard." She turned away, her skin prickling with anticipation. Would Vern now come flying at her from behind, eager to redress his failure by slaying the only witness to it over whom he did not wield authority? She heard the slight scrape of Vern's armour on the deck as the other Archon rose to his feet, but this was not followed by any hiss of rage or the sound of a weapon being recovered from a fallen warrior to strike Dimera down while her back was turned. Dimera was not naive enough to believe Vern would consider himself beholden to her for intervening to save his life, but perhaps he was content to let things stand for now, rather than risk attacking a warrior armed with blast pistol and venom blade. The rush and exhilaration of battle began to fade, and Dimera looked out over her surroundings. The orcs had been culled, although they had exacted a high price for it. It was a sobering reminder that no matter how inferior the Arrakia were in many ways, They were still capable of doing appalling damage when allowed to fight in the manner of their choosing. As to the manner of their arrival, Dimera looked up at where the orcs had emerged. There was nothing there now. Merely the dark skies of Camorra rising to meet the mighty curve of the membrane that separated Port Tavar from the murderous warp itself. The Port Gate was up there, Port Tavar's largest and primary entrance and exit. Dimera could see the jagged shapes of the docking spires and even make out the tiny shapes of starships tethered in gravity-free anchorage far above. One of them was the Heart's End, her personal flagship on which was mounted Voidbreaker, the largest dark lance ever created by a Drukhari artisan. The orcs had not fallen from the port gate. They had emerged far closer. Nor had they jumped from any form of skycraft, not even a captured Drukhari one. There was only one explanation for how they had come to be here, and so suddenly at that. Little inspired terror in the Drukhari, for their souls were jaded and hardened by the millennia of pain and suffering they inflicted on others in their own quests to satisfy the pull of she who thirsts and keep their mortality at bay. But something closed a cold fist around Dimera's heart now. A movement beside her alerted her to the presence of Sistriel Verne, coming up to stand next to her at the Tantalus's rail. The other Archon made no mention of how close he had come to death, nor of Dimera's involvement in it, and did not even pass comment on her presence on his craft. Instead, Verne's face was drawn and his eyes haunted, for he recognized the truth just as Dimera did.
"They are teleporting," Verne said, in a voice that was only flat because of the work being done to keep it under control.
An Archon could not let weakness be seen, lest their rivals seek to capitalize, and the ambitious traitors within their own ranks become emboldened. And yet, Sistriel Verne was teetering on the edge of it.
"They are," Dimera agreed, and her own throat nearly betrayed her, because the enormity of what she had brought down upon them was starting to sink in. Camorra was a bastion against the malice and hunger of the warp, a shelter in which the Drukhari lived out their lives and from which they only emerged for short periods, so the drain upon their souls from She Who Thirsts did not grow too great. The Dark City had endured for over 10,000 years, but that did not mean that it was inviolable. If a portion of the webway was breached, then attackers could reach Camorra's gates, and although a webway portal could only be operated by an Eldari, the minions of Chaos had many tricks by which they could gain entry. Even the structure of the city was not fully safe, for during a disjunction, the boundaries themselves could become breached. Entire subrealms could be lost and have to be sealed off, with those left inside abandoned to their doom, simply in order to prevent the contagion from spreading any further. Teleportation was one of the most foolhardy practices undertaken by the younger species of the galaxy, for it involved literally throwing oneself through the warp with imperfect guidance and little protection. Only the warp spiders, aspect warriors of the craft worlds, practiced it amongst all the Eldari, and even they took great risks in doing so due to how their souls stood out like beacons in the warp. The Mon Key of the Imperium did their miserable best to insulate themselves from the warp's predators with the pathetic emblems of their shackled god, but no Eldari would risk such an imprecise method. The odds were good that demons would swarm to the light of an individual's soul and consume them, or worse, before they emerged again. And then there were the orcs, the Arrakia, who lacked even the human stumbling, flawed sense of self-preservation in such matters. Only the most heavily armoured, iron-willed monkey stood a chance of surviving teleportation. But orcs happily threw themselves through the warp with no concern, content in the knowledge that they would end up fighting something.
Their methods were unshielded, haphazard, and chaotic. And now they were teleporting inside Kamora. This was no longer just an insult, but a real threat, far greater than that posed by the orcs themselves or their crude but dangerous weapons. The orcish army might destroy buildings and slaughter Drukhari, but those were losses that Dimera was content to risk, so long as it was not her buildings or her life. The Arrakia's teleportation, however, might open the way into Kamora for the demons that lurked in the warp, forever pawing at the walls, separating them from the delicious morsels within. That could be ruinous. If a breach occurred, Dimera would not be safe, even if she managed to escape into another sub-realm of the Dark City. Asdrubale Vect would brook no threat to his domain, and his warriors would be given orders to isolate and execute any refugees from such a tragedy, just in case they had unknowingly brought the faintest seed of chaos out with them. "We cannot wait for the witch cults," Dimera heard herself say. "We must exterminate this threat ourselves immediately."
"Agreed," Sistrul Vern declared.
He glanced sideways at Dimera and gave the faintest nod. It appeared that a genuine truce was being offered, rather than the traditional lip service. Dimera could not count on Vern and the Cabal of the Falling Night for a moment longer than it would take to wipe the orcs out, but until that moment, they could work together. Dimera vaulted up onto the rail of the Tantalus, balancing fearlessly above the gulf below, and gestured to the pilot of her venom to approach. The cold terror in her gut was already twisting into anger. How dare the Arrakia threaten the very substance of her domain? How dare they overreach themselves in such a manner? They were her tools, but they had turned in her hand. Well, now she would exact her revenge and carve fear of her kind into their carcasses until the survivors were no more than whimpering hunks of broken flesh. She set her carrier waves to broadcast as far and wide as she could. Let her voice be heard by all those assembled here, and let them know that she was in command. "Sharpen your blades! And open the portals," Dimera Thrakes commanded. "We ride to the death of our enemies." Chapter 9. Snaggy had chosen just the right moment to make his move, if he said so himself, which he did, although quietly to make sure no one overheard. Some grots, fools like Nisquik, were deluded enough to believe that a grot's natural place in the galaxy was as a servant to an orc. Nisquik didn't like being kicked around, yelled at, and generally abused, but he was incapable of imagining anything else. Snaggy had never even tried to talk to the other grot about the possibility of a life not at the mercy of orcish oppression, because he knew a lost cause when he saw one. Then there were the few grots, like Snaggy, although no one was actually like Snaggy, the gods had broken the mould when they created him, who recognised their condition for what it was. Intolerable. Unacceptable. The endlessly repeating tragedy of what happened when strength was allowed to win out over intelligence. The gods embodied the dual nature of the orcish species, both brutal and cunning in different amounts. But orcs themselves were essentially just squigs with the ability to use language and weapons. It was grots who were the true chosen of Gork and Mork, because they were not only willing to stick the other gear, but capable of choosing the best time to do so. This was why Snaggy was a prophet of Gork and Mork, although he kept quiet about that around orcs, because they tended to be unable to handle the truth of it. However, most grots sat in the middle. They didn't live in the unquestioning ignorance of those like Nisquik, who were only content with their lot because they couldn't conceive of anything better, but nor did they have the vision, the courage, or the sheer moral fibre to actively envisage change. Most grots live lives of sulky misery and casual spite, spreading their own suffering out to as many other life forms as they could get away with. Their directionless resentment was like a reservoir, released in little dribbles with a shank in here, or the application of an oversized wrench to the shins of another grot there. But it was still a massive amount of potential energy just waiting to be tapped by a grot with the ingenuity to harness it. In a normal situation, that reservoir was sluggish and immobile. This, though, was far from a normal situation. The orcs had dragged them all through into wherever in the gods' names this was, a completely unnatural spiky city that was dark and smelled of dust and blood and death, but not in a fun, invigorating way, and everyone's nerves were on edge. Spikies were just plain old nasty, and that was an end to it. Every grot knew that beakies were rock-hard and deadly, and bug-eyes had too many arms and too many claws, and tinheads had guns what could blast you into the smallest bits of small that you could imagine before you could say oi. And every grot was sensibly and justifiably terrified of these things. However, if there was one good thing about these possible deaths, and Snaggy wasn't convinced that there was, but if there was, it was that they would be quick. Spikies didn't make it quick. Spikies, in fact, seemed to rather enjoy dragging it out. Information was a bit scarce on exactly what they did, because no one really got away, and no grot with any sense hung around close enough to get a proper view. But it was generally known to all that spikies and their knives were to be avoided at all costs. So, that was where they were now. An awful lot of grots who'd been dragged, kicked and herded through alarming portals into a place with few obvious exits, and where the shadows into which they might normally flee quite conceivably harboured spikies with blades that thirsted for grot blood. The orcs were having a great time of it, of course, stomping anyone they came across and blowing up whatever they pleased. But the spikies who lived here kept appearing and attacking, then running away again before too many of them could be killed. Snaggy knew it was only a matter of time before the gits decided that the orcs were a bit too tough and that they wanted to have a go at the grots instead. Typical spiky cowardice, wanting to fight grots just because they were easier to kill. This was exactly the sort of situation in which a skilled orator could reach out and take a listener's fears to give them just the right nudge, to turn that churning mass of guileless resentment and bile into something useful.
"This can't go on,"
he said to his twitching and flinching audience as they huddled together in the wreckage of a battle wagon that had been the victim of either spiky heavy weaponry or poor mech boy engineering.
"The orcs have gone too far this time. This ain't a place for the likes of us. We're bothering the spikies in their own holes, and they're not going to rest until we're all sliced up and..."
He broke off, scowling at a scuffle at the back.
"What's going on over there?"
Gip, whom Snaggy had identified as large but lazy, and therefore the perfect sort of hench grot, smacked the two smaller grots causing the disruption around the head.
"They were fighting about the sky. Couldn't agree if it's white and gold or black and blue."
Snaggy peered upwards through a jagged hole in the thick metal and snorted. The sky was strange, that was true enough, with the weird glyphs that seemed to be burned on it, but were only visible when you weren't looking directly at them. However, the colour was obvious. It was definitely, well, you know, actually, now he came to look at it.
"Honestly, don't know what you're squabbling about,"
he said with a dismissive snort.
"It's obvious what colour it is, but that's just me point,"
he continued hastily before anyone could ask him to express an actual opinion on the subject.
"This place is weird. Causes sensible grots to doubt the evidence of their own eyes. This ain't where the gods want us to be."
"How do you know what the gods want?"
someone sneered from the middle of the crowd. Snaggy's eyes found him almost immediately.
scrawny even by Grot standards, with the tip of his nose missing.
"'Cause they talk to me,'
Snaggy said, with simple pride, and awaited his acclamation. A couple of his audience scoffed loudly. Most just sort of looked at him a bit funny. A few grots, the one Snaggy had already identified as likely to lose to a squig in a counting competition, made impressed ooing noises. Well, this infuriated him, because it ran counter to everything that was supposed to happen. It should be the smart ones who realised the truth of his divine right, while the fools rejected him. It was hardly going to impress anyone if his most devoted followers struggled to walk and talk at the same time. Still, no one had actually left. And maybe that was partly because they were already in the best bit of cover available, while the orcs tried to prosecute a war against an enemy that refused to stand and fight them. But so what? Well, that just meant Snaggy was a genius for choosing this as the location for his first move. And there were a few, Gip amongst them, who were eyeing him as close to thoughtfully as their brains would allow. They could tell that he was something special. If they stuck close to him, they might be able to bask in his reflected glory. That was all he needed.
"Sounds to me like a few of you lads ain't convinced,"
Snaggy said, knowingly. Only a few, it wouldn't do him good to acknowledge anything more than that. Grots always sought safety in numbers anyway, so if he could make his doubters think that there weren't many of them, then his job would be easier.
"Now, I ain't saying I'm a weird boy what's going to start spitting out prophecies or anything like that, but I get glimpses of the gods' intentions." "What does it look like?"
asked a tubby grot, whose eyes were hidden behind overlarge goggles. His voice held an appropriate tone of wonder, and Snaggy smiled beatifically.
"It's green."
That was met with a few more nods, although some of the nodders then paused and looked dubious again, because obviously any visions sent by Gawk and Mork would be green. What else would they be? Snaggy could tell he hadn't won many over. Tough crowd, this one. And decided to risk one of his genuine bits of knowledge.
"The gods," he said, "have shown me how we can get out of here."
That caught his audience's attention. Grots pressed in closer, whispering excitedly amongst themselves. It was a lie, of course. Snaggy had seen actual visions from Gawk and Mork, but this was something he'd picked up on his own. Still, if he wanted to gain followers, then he was better off making them believe that he was guided by the gods, which in this case meant giving the gods credit for something they'd had no hand in. Snaggy doubted that they'd mind.
"What are we going to need,"
he said, in a hushed, conspiratorial tone,
"is a spy key. It's going to need to be alive, I reckon, but it don't need to be healthy. They're the ones what can open the gates. So long as we've got one of them, we can get a gate to open and sog off and leave the orcs to have their fun without us." "Leave the orcs!"
exclaimed the grot without the tip of his nose, looking around in horror as though a runt herd was about to emerge from the shadows, bellowing with rage and swinging a grot lash.
"How are we going to survive?"
Snaggy took two steps forward and dealt his doubter a ringing slap around the ear.
"That's negative thinking,"
he barked before the slappee could gather his wits enough to object.
"You ain't going to get far like that. All of you know what's going to happen here. The orcs are going to throw us in the way of anything what's coming at them, and a lot of us are going to die anyway. Whereas if we disappear first, maybe nicking a few tanks and whatnot along the way."
He waggled his brow suggestively.
"Look, all I'm saying is that there's got to be a whole lot of different worlds what are less stabby than this place. Places where a bunch of grots with a bit of their own dacha could live like war bosses."
He could see the idea take hold, just like it had when he'd floated it before. What if there weren't any orcs telling us what to do? The words of a true visionary.
The gods never meant for us to be stuck fetching and carrying and taking a kicking from these gits, he said, warming to his subject. They want the grots to be free. They want the grots to be in charge. I'm the one that can get you there. I'm the grot boss.
This wasn't exactly met with rapturous applause and immediate declarations of undying allegiance, but Snaggy reckoned that more than half now looked hopeful or interested in what he had to say.
This offer ain't going to be here for long, he said. And you want to get in on the ground floor, so to speak, before word spreads and everyone wants a piece of it. Get in now and get to good positions, because the grot boss is going to need other bosses to keep everyone organised. You know, some lads what can do good thinking, or can knock a few heads together and keep order.
He looked pointedly at Gip, who showed his sharp little teeth in a knowing grin.
So you're going to lead us?
Asked the grot he'd slapped.
That's right,
Snaggy replied, puffing his chest out.
What's your name? Gecky Shortnose. Well, Gecky,
Snaggy said expansively, throwing one arm around the other grot's shoulders and squeezing just hard enough to hint that another slap might be on the way if he got any cheek.
This is a great day for you. You can say that you were there at the start of the Great Rebellion. So, you're going to get us a spiky?
Gecky asked, his eyes wide. Far too wide, in fact. Snaggy knew deliberate innocence when it sidled up and stabbed him, and his own eyes narrowed in displeasure.
You what? A spiky,
Gecky repeated.
You said we need one to get through the gates, right? And if you're leading us, you're going to get us a spiky, right?
Snaggy laughed derisively.
Look, just because I said we need to get one, don't mean it's going to be me, what? Spiky,
the other grots began to chant.
Spiky.
Now look, Snaggy said, trying to keep the desperation out of his voice.
That's not spiky, spiky. I really don't think that's spiky, spiky. Right,
Snaggy bellowed, with visions of his new authority fading away in a cloud of his own desperate excuses.
I'll get the zoggin' spiky, but I'm going to need help to carry it, he continued, looking around furiously. So, anyone who wants to be a direct underboss, no questions asked, you step forward right now and say you're coming with me.
There was no movement for a moment, then another moment, then a whole handful of moments which scurried past in a group as though trying to evade a predator. Snaggy glowered at his potential followers, wondering how long this standoff could last. He really couldn't get a spiky all on his own. He wouldn't be able to shift one quickly enough, even if he found one dead enough to drag but not alive enough to shank him, which was going to be a tall order in and of itself. Was this it?